By Charlie Thompson, Chief Executive Officer of the Society of Florida. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm grateful for the opportunity to address the committee. I've been Chief Executive of Equitable Life Insurance Society since the 1st of March 2001. The board and the management of the society changed completely at about that time. None of the current directors nor senior executives had any involvement in Equitable Life before 2001, and none of the senior management or directors before 2001 had any part in the direction of the society after April 2001. During the next few minutes, I'd like to give you a little background about Equitable Life and what we've been doing since 2001 to address its many problems. I'll also try to correct one or two common misunderstandings. As the Chief Executive of a mutual, my responsibility is to all of the Society's members and policyholders, and we've been working hard to improve the position of the Society and consequently the outlook for policyholders over that time. We're now more stable and more secure than at any time since I took over. Solvency is up year on year, surrenders are down, and reserves have been strengthened. In 2001, well over a million people had an interest in the with-profits fund. The vast majority of these were in the UK, but the Society also had nearly 8,000 with-profit policyholders in Ireland and nearly 4,000 with-profit policyholders in Germany. The Society had also established a branch in Guernsey through which international business could be opened. The Society had also established a branch in Guernsey through which international business could be written, and a number of EU policyholders had taken out policies through that branch. The Society operated a unique methodology different from all of its competitors in the UK with regard to bonus declarations, and probably also with regard to surrender values when contracts were terminated early. It was also unusual in that all of the with-profits business was operated as a single fund, with, in the UK, only a single bonus series. No differentiation was made between policies taken out before and after 1988, with and without guaranteed annuity rate options, the so-called GARs, and those before and after 1996, with and without guaranteed interest rates, GIRs. The society that my fellow directors and I took over was badly damaged. The new board wanted to understand the position of policyholders. The chairman and I toured the UK with a series of roadshows to meet policyholders and to understand their worries and concerns. Some thought that they were in danger of losing all of their money. Others were angry and frustrated that what they'd expected was not now going to happen. There was a considerable tension between policyholders who had GARs and those who did not. The new board contemplated how to resolve those problems and dealt with the GAR tension through the compromise scheme. The board contemplated how to resolve the problems. It dealt with the GAR tension through the compromise scheme, which was approved by the court in February 2002. The scheme removed GARs and also settled all potential GAR-related complaints by policyholders against the society. This resolved most of the GAR problems, except for those policyholders who had taken policy proceeds before the scheme became effective in February 2002. Two schemes addressed those issues. The rectification scheme to compensate GAR policyholders who had retired before GARs were correctly applied, and the non-GAR leaver scheme, which addressed GAR-related complaints for non-GAR policyholders who had surrendered or retired before February 2002. The board recognised that policyholder behaviour in such unprecedented circumstances was impossible to predict, and so the board worked hard to create stability in the fund. The board also considered who should be held accountable for what had happened in society. We took legal advice as to whether the society should be pursuing what had gone wrong through the European courts or through a process like this committee of inquiry. We were clear from the advice that we received that there was no European route open to the society, and we informed policyholders of that at our AGM in 2004. We were also clear that there was no realistic prospect of successfully suing the UK regulator. Following consideration of the legal, audit and actuarial advice that we received, and with very strong backing from policyholders and from action groups, we proceeded to pursue the former directors and the former auditors, culminating in court proceedings last year. To our great disappointment, we were unable to establish that loss had been caused that could be attributed to those defendants. At this stage, it's important to be precise about the loss we were pursuing, which was corporate loss. That's the diminution in the value of the society as an entity, not individual policyholder losses. We were clear that the value of the society had been damaged by the previous management. The business would have been saleable during the early part of the 1990s, but had become unsaleable by 2000. We pursued that corporate loss through the courts, but without success. Turning to the position of individual policyholders, the only loss that is clearly due to the particular circumstances of Equitable Life is that related to GARS, in other words, related to the Hyman judgment in July 2000. That loss is a maximum of around 5% policy value, and for most policyholders was compromised by the scheme in February 2002. Other losses are usually market related and would have happened to a greater or lesser degree with other providers of with-profit funds. We have dealt with over 100,000 complaints and individual cases of potential loss, mainly through our policy reviews. I should mention specifically the rectification scheme with 75,000 cases, the potential GAR complaints from former policyholders, 15,000 cases, the managed pension review, 20,000 cases, as well as many, many individual complaints, referrals to the Financial Ombudsman Service, the FOS, and individual or group cases pursued through the UK courts. Non-UK policyholders from within the EU have used those routes. In particular, FOS has looked at cases sold through the Guernsey branch, and other non-UK policyholders have claimed through UK solicitors. Cases of mis-selling have been offered redress when that's appropriate, but there are many cases where no redress is appropriate. When the society pays redress, it can only come from current policyholders. So we owe those policyholders a duty to refuse to make payments when no redress is appropriate. I've mentioned the rectification scheme that dealt with policyholders whose contracts had matured before the House of Lords judgment. It gave them the benefits that they would have got had the Hyman judgment been known at that time. The scheme for non-GAR leavers dealt with policyholders who took their benefits before the compromise scheme took effect. Following legal advice, the society produced a scheme offering compensation to those who had joined relatively recently at the maximum 5% level of loss. The reason for that was that attempting to assess individual losses for many thousands of different cases would have been prohibitively expensive, and therefore all were offered redress at the maximum level. That was a more pragmatic solution, we believe. The great majority accepted those offers. About 1,000 cases where policyholders did not accept were referred by those policyholders to the Financial Ombudsman Service. The FOS, on this occasion showing its independence from the FSA, took different legal advice and disagreed with the position both of the society and of the FSA regulator. The FOS basis looked at individual assessments of loss without the cap, and that can lead to higher or lower numbers than the society scheme. Given the relatively small number of cases covered by that clause review, the society decided not to incur the costs of judicial review of the FOSS and has therefore been settling cases on the FOSS basis with the remaining complainants. A recent legal ruling from the UK Court of Appeal gives strong support to the society's initial position, and therefore the cap of 5% does seem to be an appropriate measure of the maximum loss suffered by policyholders who did not have GARS, and therefore a benchmark that may be of some value to this committee. There have been many claims that seek to recover market-related losses, but on the basis of the advice that the society has consistently received, we have declined to pay such losses. We have said that policyholders' best hope for compensation is the UK Parliamentary Ombudsman's second report. Her test does not necessarily have to establish that policyholders have suffered loss, merely that they have suffered injustice due to maladministration. It seems likely that that test would be satisfied if maladministration by the regulators is established. The Society has assisted all of the many official inquiries into what went wrong with Equitable Life. Already, we have had the Corley report, the Baird report, the Parliamentary Ombudsman's first report, and the report by Lord Penrose. Those various reports are far from unanimous in their conclusions, and in some areas they are not consistent with our own analysis and advice. We believe that this illustrates the complexity of the issues, which generate very difficult legal, accounting, and actuarial debates. There are still five separate forums investigating the past of Equitable Life. There is this committee, there is the Parliamentary Ombudsman's second report, there are professional investigations by the Institute of Actuaries and by the Joint Disciplinary Scheme of the Accountancy Profession. Finally, we have a group claim by 400 with-profit annuitants that covers much of the same territory. This claim was initiated by one of the policyholder action groups. Although I'm no expert on the implementation process for EU life directives, I do have a lot of experience of dealing with the resulting regulation within the UK. For many years, the regulators in the UK had very extensive powers to raise questions with companies and considerable powers to intervene in exceptional cases. Specifically, the Secretary of State had the power to intervene if the reasonable expectations of policyholders or prospective policyholders were not being met. And I can give you a web reference to papers produced by the actuarial profession in the early 1990s that demonstrate that background. In short, my view is that the relevant regulators in the UK, both before and after the changes made as a consequence of the Consolidated Life Directive, had sufficient powers to regulate effectively. Therefore, the questions that interest us at Equitable Life and that are currently being investigated by the Parliamentary Ombudsman are whether the regulatory system should have called the society to manage its financial position and its risks differently. While I believe that mistakes were made in how the society was managed before 2001, I do not believe that society was insolvent at any point. The more extreme claims made by some commentators are therefore simply wrong. I've tried not to comment on these extreme statements because I do have great sympathy for our policyholders, the losses they've suffered, and the shortfall against their hopes. However, I do not believe that it is helpful to our chances of obtaining redress for our policyholders if these statements continue to be made. In particular, the Ponzi scheme allegations are wrong. Ponzi scheme refers to a case where the organisation was trading while insolvent. It is true that the society paid out bonuses during the 1990s that eroded most of its capital, but the society was never insolvent, so there is no correspondence with the circumstances of the Ponzi scheme. With-profits annuities are pensions, where the level of payment depends on the bonuses paid by the with-profits funds. In order to make the starting level of the pension comparable with other types of annuity, most policyholders chose to anticipate a certain level of bonus below the then current levels of bonus, but well above more recent bonus rates. That anticipated bonus rate was chosen by the policyholder at commencement and fixed throughout the life of the policy. That choice produces a minimum guaranteed level of income, which steadily reduces over time. Reductions in guaranteed payments are offset by the actual bonuses added. In a time of high interest rates, high bonus rates, and high inflation, many policyholders chose a high anticipated bonus rate, and those rates continue to apply today. At commencement, this choice of a high anticipated bonus rate during high inflation is consistent with an expectation of deterioration in the purchasing power of the annuity year by year, even if the sterling amount stayed level or rose modestly. Now that inflation is much lower and investment returns are also lower, bonus rates are often lower than the anticipated bonus rate, and so the sterling amount of the annuity reduces each year. That reduction, coupled with low inflation, can give a reduction in purchasing power year by year, very similar to the high bonus and high inflation scenario. That point is complex and is not well understood, but it does explain why criticisms that are made simply because the sterling amount of with-profit annuities are reducing are often misplaced. Despite those points, as with other providers, a significant number of policyholders are claiming that they were missold. And we have worked throughout the last 5 years to separate the genuine claims from the opportunistic. Those claims have to be paid by policyholders. I'm therefore naturally concerned that we only pay when redress is due and not simply to those who shout loudest. We've taken extensive legal and actuarial advice before setting up the criteria for assessing mis-selling. We have discussed our approach at length with the FSA as regulator and with the FOS as arbiter of claims on behalf of individuals. We need to strike a balance between the interests of the claimant and the interests of the other policyholders who pay the claim. At last, we're reaching the end of that process. It has cost hundreds of millions of pounds, all of which has had to be paid for by the policyholders I represent. However, the number of complaints is now very small compared to 5 years ago. The society itself has greatly increased stability, and there is a dramatic increase in the probability that we can meet all of the guarantees and allow the business to run off smoothly. That is a huge improvement from the position that we inherited 5 years ago. I'd like, before taking questions, simply to say that I would like, once I have seen the transcript, to write to you later about some of the more colourful allegations that have been made during this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. Indeed, and we look forward to your written responses.